from the Gothic Quarter in Barcelona. This is Market Movers, the podcast that gives you a closer look at the financial markets to trade responsibly. Here are your hosts, Lior Cohen and Yochai Elam.
Hello and welcome. Thank you for joining us and spreading the good word on a podcast and clicking the subscribe button. I'm your co-host, Lior Cohen. And joining me, much like the financial markets, he's also frustrated from the yell and yawn, Yochai Elam. How's it going, Yochai?
Hi, Lior. I'm doing great. Yeah, trying not to look much into the United States. They aren't moving the market in the right way. It was indeed a yell and yawn, yeah.
We thought there will be some big expectations from the minutes and of the FOMC, and it was another dud. We'll have to talk about, and on this week's podcast, we'll also examine the recent developments in the U.S. housing market, talk about the minutes, of course, of FOMC, review the latest news from Japan of the upcoming elections, and the upcoming reports and news from Europe, OPEC, and at the end of the show, we'll also have a quote of the week. But first, the housing market. The U.S. housing market has been doing a little bit better than what you would have expected, considering only, 6 years ago it was in a bit of a collapse, but...
Just a tiny little bump in the road,
but we won't hold it against it.
Yeah.
Let's take a little bit of a panoramic look about what happened in the last few years and quickly move to where is it in its current state and where is it heading now. So Yochai, take us through it. What's your thoughts about it and where it was a few years back?
Well, of course, as we know, there was a boom and bust in the housing market. We won't talk about all the reasons in depth for the boom and for the bust, but just to cover this topic quickly, we had a bubble fueled by low interest rates by the Fed, by both Greenspan and also later Bernanke. Also, the government, the U.S. government, led by George W. Bush, helped reach an owning society. They helped buy houses. And of course, there was also a lot of greed from homebuyers, from the media that encouraged buying houses.
The point is, ladies and gentlemen, that greed, for lack of a better word, is good.
And from the banks, and especially what they did with all the collateralizing, all these CDOs and other letters that got that super AAA ratings and then caused the crisis.
All those funny initialisms, we know all about it, and a few years ago, nobody knew about what's a CDO, what's all those other initialisms. But now it's pretty ubiquitous, and everybody are covering their bases and know exactly what they mean.
Right.
When you talk about greed, I thought that greed was good. I thought that Michael Douglas all taught us that greed is good, no?
Well, greed is good until it goes wrong. So
until you go bust. Yeah.
Yeah, until you go greedy on these collateralized derivatives and all that. So I highly recommend seeing the movie Inside Job, which has a good look at this at the boom and the bust. But let's look at prices. So prices peaked in mid 2006. The Fed didn't see it, of course, and they deteriorated afterwards, and the deterioration accelerated in 2008, the year of the crisis of Lehman Brothers. Since then, we had some movements. It wasn't a one-way street. We had some green shoots between 2009 and 2011, but then we fell to a new low in 2012. From there, we had a nice recovery. I think QE3 was also responsible for that, although it's controversial about how much the QE programs contributed to the recovery of the housing market. What do you think?
Yeah, I think that this kind of thing, when you look at the QE program, especially the QE3, which was very toned towards mortgage-backed securities, I think that if you look at it, it didn't have much of an impact on either mortgages. When you look at the interest rate, the mortgages remained pretty flat in the past year, around 4%, and the applications have picked up a little bit, but still, it's not something that you would have seen much of a big shift. And even if you look at Mortgage Bankers Association, they reveal mortgage applications and refinance index, you will see that there has been a sharp decline in the refinance index. This is the index that shows the number of refinance applications submitted and not measure the number of refinance loans that are actually closed. And this has sharply declined the past year, and it could in partly be because of the FOMC's efforts to buy mortgage-backed securities.
Yeah, I think also regulation plays a role in the housing market. And well, we heard from Bernanke that the bearded guy couldn't take a mortgage, even though he makes a lot of money, which sounds quite weird. But
what, are you talking about Santa or Bernanke? Or
no, Santa Bernanke. Yeah, we're getting close Santa to Christmas. Yeah.
Yeah, we're taking close to Christmas, so we have to reference that. And yeah, you're right that it had some impact. I'm not saying not QE programs, but I think it was much limited than what people would have expected, considering the Fed expanded its balance sheet so rapidly in the past few years. But I think it was pretty limited, and you see it either from the mortgage rates or in other applications such as mortgage applications. Okay, so there was a bit of a rally in the past year, and take us through the numbers. What were the numbers?
We have the built permits at 1.08 million annualized. All the figures of building permits and housing starts are always annualized. It's the highest since June 2008. Also, house prices, which we talked about before, are back to the 2008 levels. They're not at the bubble levels, but they're at least the highest post-crisis levels. Housing starts, also here, 101 million. It's just below the peak that was reached in July at 1.12, and that was the highest since November 2007. New home sales, that's perhaps the most important figure, because when you construct a new house, there's a lot of investment related to infrastructure around it, building schools, stores, of course, lawyers and accountants.
Yeah, so it's more about that this kind of thing, this kind of measure of new home sales. It's also an entire industry that goes around it, and thus also improves other sections of the economy as well. It's not just the housing, it's other aspects, as you said, the other freelancers, and you have lawyers, accountants, you have other supporting industries that take into account, not just the construction, also, of course, banking. So they have other implications. Yeah. And if you look at the construction, also other the big companies that produce, for instance, heavy machinery, Deere, Caterpillar, these kind of industries also benefit from an improved housing market.
Right, IKEA, everybody makes furniture.
Yeah, Home Depot, and yeah.
Now, research has shown that throughout history, there is a very, very strong correlation between housing growth and general growth, and the other way around. And we can look at it at different aspects. For instance, when people have more money, when the economy is doing better, the youngsters leave their the parents' house earlier, and they don't know, rent an apartment in the middle of the city. Or others get married and have children and buy new homes. When it's the other way around, a couple stays with the parents, a youngster stays until the age of 30, even 40 here in Spain, it's not that uncommon.
Yeah, it's pretty common in Europe, right? That people stay very long because of such high house prices. They just stay at home, right? Even in their 40s, and they get married and still stay home, right? It's pretty common.
Yeah, so in the United States, with studying in colleges which are far away, young people leave their parents' house earlier, usually, than in Europe. But if they decide to buy a house, if they spend money on furniture, if they're that's where we feel the correlation between the economy and the new homes. In addition, there's also what the Fed talked about, and that's the wealth effect. So if prices go up, you feel more comfortable in buying more stuff and spending on a new car.
Yeah, taking a second mortgage and starting to cash in. But that's the problem, by the way. I see it so often that people take a second mortgage or even third mortgage. I don't know, maybe today it's a little bit harder to take a third mortgage, but second mortgage is pretty common still. And you just use it to spend and to increase their consumption. They don't take that second mortgage and put it towards investing that they could, you know, maybe yield a better return than what they actually have to pay the interest rate for the mortgage, but they actually take it to spend. And after that, okay, what's next? Then you're left with a much bigger mortgage on your house.
Yeah.
This is something that people also should take into account, but yeah, it's a tangent. Let's get back to what you're talking about, the wealth effect.
It did work very well in the past, the second, third mortgage thing. But now I think the crisis has left a big scar and regulation is stronger, so it doesn't happen that much. But yeah, a second mortgage can happen, or just spending more money because you feel more secure, or and especially if you feel that your home is worth more, that your mortgage isn't underwater. So there is a very, very strong correlation. And the Fed acknowledges that. In the past, Bernanke and Yellen have expressed a concern over low home prices, or that home prices are stuck. They did say that QE in general, the fact that it lifts stocks and home prices, contributes to a wealth effect, contributes to confidence and to the economy in general, to more jobs. But of course, they're aware that of the role, well, they didn't admit it that strongly, but they're aware of the role that inflating bubbles can be dangerous. And they're also aware that part of their job is not only employment and inflation, but also financial stability.
A wealth effect, I think in a way, it's pretty much a bubble by itself when you think about it, because people think if they're not going to sell their house, they won't see the wealth effect until they sell it. And in the meantime, they can maybe take another second mortgage and just consume more and, you know, take another vacation, stuff like that, which is, it's fine, do whatever you want, but it's something that eventually, if there will be a suddenly sharp decline in prices, as was the case back in 2007, 2008, and you don't sell your house, then that's it. It's game over for you. You won't have an opportunity to cash in on this wealth effect and subtract it from the current debt that you have on the house.
Right. And it's not as liquid as stock, so it's not easy to get rid of.
Yeah, exactly. It's not that people buy and sell every couple of years. It's something usually people buy it and hold on to it for decades. I know that the markets talk about it, the FOMC talks about it, but I think it's still something a little bit tricky to refer to the wealth effect. I think it's by itself, there's a big component of bubble in it. But okay, so there's that, and where do you see the Fed's role in the bank, in where the housing market is currently at and where it's heading?
Well, they were a bit more concerned about it, I think, last year, because the rise in prices seemed to stop, and so did other parameters, for instance, new home sales, which are perhaps the most important thing. But I think it's now a bit back to the back burner, because we have improving jobs and sort of stuck inflation, and wages are now more important with the debate on the minimum wage and with average hourly earnings stuck. Anyway, housing is less in the limelight, but it could come back, especially now that QE is over, and I see almost zero chance that it will see QE4 or something like that. We could see a bit more of a slowdown in housing. If it's a moderate slowdown, that means we don't have any bubble, and that's good news. But if it's too much, it means the economy cannot stand on its own.
If I look at the numbers, by the way, about you talk about prices, we can also look at the Case-Shiller National Home Price Index, which measures the houses. It has been steadily rising, and it's now around 167, the index. And just to a reference point, at the peak in November 2006, it was right before the collapse, it was at 183. So it has gone pretty upwards. It's not in the levels pre-bubble, but it has gone up from 136 back in November 2011, that was the bottom, all the way up to 167. So it has gone up in the past 3 years or so. So we do see, as you said, we do see a recovery in the home prices. But partial bubble, partial real growth in demand. And as you said, the US economy has been doing a little bit better in the past couple of years or so. So we should see some real impact on the economy. Circling back to FOMC, okay, where do you see it's heading now?
Well, if price rises come despite the end of QE, at least active QE, the Fed is only maintaining its balance sheet but not expanding it, and if price rises are seen of above 3 or even above 5% year over year, I think it could contribute to an earlier rate hike. The Fed would like to avoid further bubbles, and I think it would come back to the limelight. The Fed wouldn't want to be seen as inflating another bubble. It already did that once, at least once. In housing,
you can do it once and it will be, yeah, it will be, yeah, once, shame on you, twice, yeah, shame on me. So yeah, it's not gonna, yeah, so we hope it's not gonna happen again. For now, you know, considering that interest rates are very low and they have been pumping a lot of money into the system, people could be concerned about whether or not it's gonna, instigate suddenly another bubble, or it will pop another bubble, at least now the QE has ended, and maybe when interest rates will go up, we'll see that collapse. But for now, it doesn't seem that it's not in the big proportions as it was a few years ago, especially as you said earlier, also there's more regulation on housing markets, so this is another issue to consider.
Right. There's also a bit more, the debt deleveraging that US citizens have undergone since the crisis, I think it's about to bottom out, so people might have more money, but that doesn't necessarily mean they'll put it into homes because they've been hit once, and so has the Fed. Yet again, just conclude by saying that if we do see continued price rises that are, let's say, above 3%, it could impact the Fed on an earlier rate hike. If we have up to 3%, I think it'll be good news. Steady recovery together with steady recovery in other fields.
Okay, so it's not on the, as you said, it's a little bit of a back burner for the FOMC. They don't put much emphasis now, at least on the housing market. They see it pretty stable, maybe a little bit growing a little bit faster, a little bit slower, but not something too earth shattering. And we'll use that term earth shattering a little bit more in the second segment, because the minutes of the FOMC. So you cannot use earth shattering now, Yochai, so give us the brass tacks, go through it.
Well, it's the yell and yawn, no?
Yeah, the yell and yawn, yeah. We are in the yell and yawn, and nothing earth shattering, as we said earlier, and we're going to use it a lot, I think.
Yeah, 2 years ago we had kicking the can down the road regarding the euro debt crisis, and that expression has disappeared. But
so it's not what it used to be. So for considerable time, right? It's going to stay this term?
Yeah, this was one of the dovish things. There was no real debate about it. There was sort of consensus about leaving this phrase. And that's the most important thing, I guess, the timing of the first rate hike. In general, indeed, the minutes were a bit more dovish. And I think we said that last week, no, didn't we? The minutes could counter the hawkish statement with some dovishness.
Yeah, even though if you look at the markets, it didn't seem that it reacted too dovishly to these to the minutes, because at least from gold, it took another turn, another plunge following the minutes of the release of the minutes. So at least from the gold standpoint, it seems that the market reacted as if it was again pretty hawkish, or at least not as dovish as many had expected. At least that's
right.
For face value.
It was very marginally. So let's talk about basic points here. So we had they did worry about inflation expectations. We had seen some of that in the statement, but this time it was a bit more strong, I would say. But they weren't too worried about the impact of slowing global economy in Europe, in China, and Japan over the US economy. So they did acknowledge that there is a slowdown, but they didn't seem shocked by the slowdown in Europe, and especially...
They're not too worried about it.
No. So that was more hawkish, let's say.
But in regards to inflation, there was one dissenter, of course. Minneapolis President Kurt Chalakota, he said, and quote, because he believes that in light of continued sluggishness in inflation outlook and the recent slide in market-based measures of long-term inflation expectations, the committee should commit to maintaining the current target range for the federal rates at least until projected inflation 1 to 2 years ahead has returned to 2% and should continue asset purchase program at its current pace. So this is, he thought that they should continue and make it a open-end kind of QE program, but he was outvoted, of course, and he was, and the statement, by the way, the minutes didn't reveal that there were more people heading towards his point of view, right? Not like other people were in line with him, but they eventually vote along with the rest. But
no,
so it's not that. So basically, you said that inflation expectations, they're not too worried about it.
They are a bit worried, but look, United States isn't going to fall into inflation. We had the recent inflation numbers right now for October, and they showed 1.8 pace of core inflation, 1.7 in inflation. It's just under 2%. As we know, the Fed is looking into the core PC price index, which is not released now, and later on there it's a bit lower, but even with falling gold prices, nobody is complaining about it, not at the Fed. That's good deflation. It just leaves more money in pockets of consumers right before the holiday season.
Okay, so I correct myself. They show a little bit concern, but not too much to actually do something about it.
No.
Let's put it this way.
No. Also about the dollar, they weren't not that concerned. I mean, well, it's important to remember that the U.S. is more of a closed economy. And so it goes hand in hand with being less worried about what's going on in Europe, China, and Japan. All in all, we haven't seen big reactions in the markets, and I think it's because they did manage to balance the statement in a marginally dovish way.
Yeah, okay, so the yellen yawn continues. So heading forward, we'll have, the big finale FOMC meeting of the year. The ultimate, as opposed to the penultimate, and
yeah.
This time, what do you see? We'll have a little bit more of a fireworks. Will continue to be the yell and yawn.
No more yell and yawns. No, not more. No more in 2014.
No, no more.
We'll talk about that more in detail before it comes. It comes on thin liquidity, but in general, because there is a press conference and because we'll have significantly more data until then, and we have the dot chart, the famous painting by the Fed. I think we'll have more of a drama, or at least even if the Fed tries to keep it quiet in either direction, the markets will pick a direction, if not immediately, in the day afterwards, and it'll be the sort of final accord for the year, and I think it'll be a strong one. Can't tell you in which direction, because we have to wait for more data, but I'm sure it'll be interesting.
No, you wanna keep us tuned in, that's why.
Exactly,
yeah,
tune in, yeah.
Tune in, yeah, and we'll reveal what's in Yochai's brain, of course. Yeah, and we won't need an MRI for that.
No.
All right. And okay, from the Fed, let's pick it up, the pace, and move to Japan. A lot on the news in the past couple of weeks or so, right? It's something that suddenly Japan has become more interesting than what it used to be.
Oh, yeah. And well, with dollar yen, we had extremely long periods of in a dead man's chart, ECG chart, and finally, wow, it's gone mad.
It's a lot of excitement, and now it was revealed also that elections will be held, next month?
Yeah, on December 14th, that's a Sunday, on thin liquidity, because it's towards the end of the year, many are already heading towards their vacations. Anyway, why do we have this?
What's the deal? Why Shinzo Abe suddenly said, okay, let's go to elections? Yeah, it's only been 2 years, but let's do another elections. What's the deal with that?
Well, officially, Japanese government, he has decided to push back the second hike of the sales tax from October 2015 to April 2017.
Yeah, this is the very controversial tax rate hike that they had it earlier this year, right? They had one in April, and it had some bad ramifications on the Japanese economy already.
Yeah, I mean, we saw the economy surging before the tax hike, erasing this very sharply in the second quarter, and falling into official recession with small contraction in the third quarter. So in order to keep his internal opposition in the LDP party quiet, I think that's the main reason he's calling elections just after 2 years in office. And I think another political consideration is that the rival DPJ party is currently in shatters. They have a lack of leadership, and he's trying to use it to gain a longer mandate of 4 more years instead of 2, while they are still looking for a direction.
So for now, we see that the rate, the tax hike will be postponed, right? That's the main, also the one of the big news.
Yeah, I think it was expected, especially if we saw the impact of the second quarter. But now it's official. Now we have a date. He promised not to raise that, not to delay it one more time. It means in 18 months, sorry, in April 2017, we're going to have a tax hike in any case. We'll see. That's a long time in the make.
Will be a long time till then. He could probably change his mind again, but eventually they'll have to do it, right? I mean, it's not as if they have any options, because revenues from taxes aren't picking up as the same pace as their Japanese debt and the government's spending. I mean, when you look at it, Japan's debt is still to GDP, to GDP has been around 227%. Just to put some reference, Greece is 175%, Ireland 123%. So at first sight, it seems, oh my God, it's wow, that's a lot of debt. But when you look at the external debt, then Japan's is only 60% of GDP, so roughly 3 trillion out of an economy of 4.9 to 5 trillion. So it is big, but when you look at the external, it's pretty low. Just another reference, US external debt is 106% out of GDP. So you can see that Japan is much more self-contained when it comes to its debt than other leading economies. It's not gonna deteriorate to a Greece or Cyprus kind of like decline because their debt is mostly internal, so they can always afford to just start printing money again. And that's what have been doing, right? That's the recent money pump that they have increased Bank of Japan.
Right, yeah. So they can increase their stimulus and, well, currently the Bank of Japan is buying more than 100% of what the Japanese government is issuing every month. So
wow,
that's a bit
that's
crazy.
A lot. That's a lot of yens, yeah.
Yeah, of course they aren't buying everything that the government is selling indirectly. They're buying only in the secondary market, but...
Yeah, but indirectly, yeah, indirectly, eventually they are buying basically government bonds. So it's, in a way, printing money, you know?
Yeah, monetary financing, debt monetization, whatever you want to call it, it's happening big time in Japan.
And will we see another monetary measure in the near future?
No, I don't think we'll see a monetary measure because we just had it now and the Bank of Japan convenes every few weeks, and now we just had another confirmation of the previous decision. And we talked last time that there was a very minor majority for this decision of the new stimulus, and in the decision that happened afterwards, there was already an 8-1 majority. So the second decision happened after the GDP release, so now there's more consensus around it.
And what are the main basic unknowns, if you will, that the big question marks remaining for Japan's economy and the government's next measures?
Yeah, so what we know that tax is delayed.
Elections are coming. Shinzo Abe will win, right? It seems that he'll slide into office again. It's not going to be a big...
Yeah, he might lose a few seats in parliament, but he still have an absolute majority. And that means that the people in his party will keep quiet. What we don't know is what kind of fiscal stimulus he's going to do. There was talk about a 3 trillion yen package, but nothing is certain. And some of this talk is, of course, part of the election campaign. If we have more stimulus, it's again negative for the yen. It's printing more money, basically. There is talk about cutting the corporate tax, but that's not a popular measure, so that was also put to rest, but I think it'll come up after the elections.
Yeah, this is something that on the one hand they want to raise sales tax, on the other hand cut corporate tax. I don't think it's going to vote well with the Japanese people, considering that, you know, this is something that will damage significantly the economy, a sales tax, especially on people, while corporate tax, they'll have a bit of a rest, so it's not something that will help Shinzo Abe's popularity.
Right, but, well, if they delay the next sales tax hike, they want to cut corporate tax, and announce a stimulus package, they're going to have to find financing for that.
Who's going to finance that
Kuroda.
That show? Yeah, who's going to finance that? Oh, there we go. That's the Santa Claus of Japanese nations. Yeah, Kuroda.
Yeah.
Yeah, he pays the bills. Yeah, he just sign it up.
Yeah, he doesn't have a beard, but he's still Santa Claus. Yeah, so.
Yeah, there we go. Yeah, so that's that. So it's good to have someone like him on your corner. And what about all the reforms that's one of Shinzo Abe's, the three pillars of... Ebonomics, or the three arrows, if you will. That's that kind of that arrow was remaining the quiver for quite a long time.
Yeah, I think it's hard to do reform. It's a bit a more conservative country. They want to change the deflation mindset. That's hard as well. I think he will avoid talking about this towards the elections, but perhaps will enact reform after the elections. Some sectors are really old-fashioned there. Another, I think, important thing he will not talk about now, but might talk about later, is nuclear energy. So for now, lower energy prices allow for a weaker yen. That means Japan imports a lot of oil, and that weighs on the trade balance, and they would want a weaker yen. It's good for exports, but not good for imports of oil. In the meantime, they have this respite of the lower oil prices. But in the bigger picture, I think what Abe will do is renew the activity in some nuclear reactors, which were all shut down gradually after the Fukushima catastrophe. If you'll do that, I think it'll also it'll allow for an even weaker yen. And I think this topic will come only in early next year, not in the next month.
So turning from Japan, let's head back to Europe. They had some news. Draghi gave a press conference, right?
Yeah, he gave a testimony in front of the European Parliament. He basically copy-pasted his own words from the previous rate decision. That's easy, no? Maybe we should do
that. Yeah, that's pretty... Yeah, so you get paid for that? I can do that.
Yeah, but you don't get paid 370,000 euros per year.
No, not even close, man. Yeah, no. It's we need to negotiate on that. Okay. So he just repeated the press conference in the recent testimony. Okay.
But he did say specifically that also bond buys are on the table, QE, sort of tickling his German counterparts on the sensitive issues. And his colleague Yves Mersch also talked about a longer list of potential things that the ECB could buy, including bonds, shares, ETFs, basically everything. And they also said that the staff that is preparing the potential list of buys basically has no taboos. It doesn't mean they'll buy a lot, it doesn't mean they'll buy everything, but these statements are meant to show that the ECB is ready to do whatever it takes in fighting deflation, and that they indeed want to reach their 1 trillion euro goal of expansion of the balance sheet really seriously.
There were some German reports recently that were released.
Yeah, they were a bit mixed. I mean, on one hand, Germany escaped recession, and also the last quarter, which showed a small contraction, this contraction became even smaller. So we had 0.1% growth and after 0.1% contraction. So no recession, but can't call it good news. We did have good news from the zoo business confidence. It finally went up and back to positive ground, back to optimism. Next week we have the IFO, the other important business survey. But on the other hand, we had the PMIs, which most importantly manufacturing was at 50 points flat in Germany, and that's a bad forward-looking indicator. All in all, these are not the most important figures. What's more important is next week's inflation. We have on Thanksgiving inflation figures from Germany, and on Friday for all the Eurozone. And this is, of course, a lead indicator into the next ECB meeting in early December.
Okay. And I'll just mention that next week, we saw that oil prices have gone pretty down in the past couple of weeks or so. It's now around $75. And next week, there is on November 27, there is the OPEC meeting, OPEC summit. It's held twice a year. Usually, it goes on without too many commotions. You just say, oh, okay, let's keep quota at 30 million barrels per day, and that's it. But this time, we might see a little bit more fireworks, especially considering that oil prices has gone so down, and some blame it to Saudi Arabia's more aggressive oil strategy. They're trying to keep their market share intact, so that's what people say. It's one of the reasons for the little bit of a price war or not. It depends who you ask. If you ask Saudi Arabia's old minister Ali Al Naimi, he says that yeah, we're just trying to defend our oil market share. We're not trying to drag oil prices to these low levels. That's that. If you look at the import of Saudi Arabia to the U.S. It has gone down. It has gone down a little bit, but still, it's not in such a low level that you would say, oh, yeah, they haven't been in that levels before. It has, they have been in such low levels. Now it's around the roughly take account for 10% of US imports. That's what they account. It has gone down a little bit, but still not in a few percentage points. It's not something earth shattering. And yes, we are using that term again, even for this issue. And on the other hand, we see that OPEC's production remained pretty stable. It gone down even a little bit at the 30.2 million barrels per day. Libya has increased production, but Libya's representative to OPEC fueled up hopes that there might be an output cut, or at least the OPEC's Libya's oil governor, OPEC governor Samir Kamal, said that to Reuters that he expects OPEC members to agree to stop producing over its target. This could mean instead of 30.2, which was last month, and the previous month I think it was a little bit higher, 30.5, something like that, they'll cut the shenanigans, keep it at 30 million, and that's it, and even a little bit below.
Yeah, they basically, if they just follow their own rules.
Smokey, this is not Nam, this is bowling. There are rules. Hey.
Yeah, those are the rules, man. And that's what they need to obey them. And yeah, so it may have gone a little bit higher, so that now they're saying, hey, you know what, Libya are slowly growing up their production, so maybe Saudi Arabia and other leading countries will step down a little bit and produce a little bit less because they don't need it anymore. They don't need their cover-up now that Libya is slowly regaining its market share. It was back in 2010, I think, before all the Arab Spring. It was around 1.6 million per day barrels, and now it's around 800,000. So it's going up, but still not in the same levels they used to be.
Yeah, and that's the sweet oil and very close to Europe. So it Libyan oil is quite important, isn't it?
Yeah, it's important. It had a big reaction when Libya's had all its turmoil back in 2010. Yeah, it's had the 2011. Sorry, it had a big turmoil and oil prices shot right up from $80 to $100 as soon as the commotion started there and the fighting. And now it's, it's gone to where it was right before the Arab Spring. So, yeah, in a way, it's not far from where it was. So at around $80, it's supposed to be, you know, a sweet spot. And that was the case, at least in 2010.
Yeah, sweet spot, sweet crude.
Yeah, sweet spot, sweet crude. And I will just mention, if people look at oil price and oil market, obviously you say, okay, the big producers are losing their shirts now with oil prices going so down. And yeah, there are, you see that in the stock market, Chevron, Exxon, BP, they are seeing sharp declines in their stock prices. But you will also notice that there are some corporates in oil market that do benefit, and they could benefit at least, and that's oil refineries, because they benefit from a wider spread between the WTI, the oil prices in the US, and Brent oil. Brent oil is the highest priced European benchmark, and it's used to determine the margin between what they buy the oil prices and what they sell them. And as such, if the spread will widen, they could benefit from it. And at least in the stock market, you see that oil refineries are doing very well. The big oil refineries, Marathon Petroleum, Valero, they have gone pretty steadily up in the past couple of weeks or so. Keep notice that even though that's what people expect, and if you ask the big companies, the big bankers, Goldman Sachs, Merrill Lynch, even the EIA, the Energy Information Administration, they expect the spread to widen a little bit in the coming months. But for now, at least in the couple, several weeks or so, it wasn't the case. We'll have to just wait and see. But for now, at least, it seems that oil refineries are doing a little bit better. Okay, and we have a quote, right, Yochai?
Yeah, so the quote is Japan is fighting demographics with monetary stimulus. If I'm not mistaken, I heard it from Brendan Greeley and Bloomberg TV. And basically, the population in Japan is shrinking. So how can you have growth and inflation? It's logical to have deflation and contraction there. And you just have to either Japanese start making babies right now, or you have to bring in more immigration. And what Japan is doing is only throwing money at the problem. And
no, that's always good to throw money at the problem.
Yeah, I can accept that kind of money. Yeah, it's okay.
Yeah, it's okay. Or turn out the lights and put some some classical music, or some Michael Bolton, if you will. I don't know. And get it on. Yeah. That should be the advice for the Japanese people. Yeah.
Yeah, but just printing money alone is probably not enough.
Yeah, that's not gonna do it. Okay, that's it for now. Thank you as usual, Yochai.
Thank you.
Thank you all for listening. And if you like our show, give us a 5-star rating on iTunes. You can subscribe to the show via Stitcher, email, RSS, or iTunes. Okay, so until next week, this is Lior signing off for Yochai, saying have a great week and invest responsibly.
For comments, suggestions, and questions, visit the podcast page at forexcrunch.com or tradingnrg.com, where you can also find past episodes and subscribe to the show. Our listeners make Market Movers possible.